ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 12, Text 26, Translation and Commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Rajarshinang Janayata Shasta Chodpathagaminam Nigrahita kaler esha Bhuvo dharmasya karanat Rajarshinam janayata Shasta chodpathagaminam Nigrahita kaler esha Bhuvo dharmasya karanat. Translation: This child, referring to Parikshit Maharaj, this child will be the father of kings who will be like sages. For world peace and for the sake of religion, he will be the chastiser of the upstarts and the quarrelsome. Purport: the wisest man in the world is a devotee of the Lord. The sages are called wise men, and there are different types of wise men for different branches of knowledge. Unless, therefore, the king or the head of the state is the wisest man, he cannot control all types of wise men in the state. In the line of royal succession, in the family of Maharaj Yudhishthira, all the kings, without exception, were the wisest men of their time. And so also it is foretold about Maharaja Parikshit and his son Maharaja Janamejaya, who is yet to be born. Such wise kings can become chastisers of upstarts and uprooters of Kali or quarrelsome elements. As will be clear in the chapters ahead, Maharaja Parikshit wanted to kill the personified Kali who was attempting to kill a cow, the emblem of peace and religion. The symptoms of Kali are 1. Wine, 2. Women, 3. Gambling, and 4. Slaughterhouses. Wise rulers of all states should take lessons from Maharaja Parikshit in how to maintain peace and morality by subduing the upstarts and quarrelsome people who indulge in wine, illicit connection with women, gambling, and meat-eating supplied by regularly maintained slaughterhouses. In this age of Kali, regular license is issued for maintaining all of these different departments of quarrel. So, how can they expect peace and morality in the state? The state fathers, therefore, must follow the principles of becoming wiser by devotion to the Lord, by chastising the breaker of discipline, and uprooting the symptoms of quarrel, as mentioned above. If we want blazing fire, we must use dry fuel. Blazing fire and moist fuel go ill together. Peace and morality can prosper only by the principles of Maharaj Parikshit and his followers. A statement here that for world peace and for the sake of religion, he will be the chastiser of the upstarts and the quarrelsome. This statement doesn't fit with the impossibly idealistic idea that for world peace one must be peaceful. That would seem to be axiomatic, but in the real world it doesn't work like that. In the real world, to maintain peace, one has to keep the non-peaceful under control. It's understood that, especially in this Kali Yuga, there will be people who will take advantage of others who are weaker than them. So, although we want to be peaceful, we have to be prepared to maintain the peace by force if necessary. By force means that not being peaceful. Peacefulness is a good quality, but we should know how to apply it. Those who are criminals, those who are rogues, neither do they deserve peaceful treatment, nor can peace be maintained if people who are by nature disturbers of the peace, if they're allowed to do their mischief. So for the sake of keeping the peace, it is required that there be law enforcers. Some years ago in London, in the United Kingdom, there were riots in some areas. And police came in from different parts of the country. And the local people who were not engaging in the riots, they cheered the police. They were very happy to see them because the law-abiding citizens felt the riots to be a great disturbance, and they couldn't prosecute their normal activities in a peaceful manner. So they appreciated very much that the police were there to violently, if necessary, control the riots. Although interestingly, it seems to be in London, in those riots, and in other situations also, it seems that more enlightened policing in the world today is to restrain with minimal force, to use force if necessary, but not to use excessive force, with the idea that if there is excessive force, then the other party, who you're trying to control, they'll become more upset. Actually, these riots were started because am I getting mixed up with different scenarios? But some riots were started somewhere by the shooting, I believe, by the police of a young black man, and then the blacks started rioting. But then if there's excessive force, more than is required. In other words, if the force seems to be vindictive rather than simply for the sake of controlling, then the other party becomes more inflamed. So force has to be applied very judiciously also. It's a very delicate thing, how to maintain the force, how to maintain the peace. Force is required, but one should not be overly forceful. I just spoke about this recently in a lecture on punishment and leniency. So those who are authorized to be forceful, not that everyone is authorized. There's a saying, taking the law into one's own hands. Sometimes there are, when the police, then they're not up to the task, they can't do a good enough job, then local groups of vigilantes, means people who they become themselves the police, ordinary citizens. But actually, one should be authorized. The Kshatriyas in Vedic culture, they are authorized to dispense force to keep the peace. Not that everyone is allowed to do that. So similarly, it's very common here in India also that people take the law into their own hands. One reason for that may be the incompetence of the police force, not necessarily blaming them, because they may be understaffed or whatever. or maybe the bias that they will protect certain people and certain communities and not other communities. So the whole situation in Kali Yuga is extremely disturbed. One of the symptoms of Kali Yuga described in Bhagavatam is vritta hinsa, which means meaningless and useless violence. Just violence, just for no reason than to give pain to others or to be revengeful to others. That's not really a reason to give pain to others. That's an extremely demoniac outlook to want to give pain to others. Or even in the name of punishing others if there's excessive... Now, in the name of stopping terrorism in the Western world, the Western powers that want to bomb the Islamic State, or not they want to, they already started it. But it just seems that they're going to make them more, they're not going to stop any terrorism, they're more likely to provoke it by doing so. But the idea that, well, the idea is that, well, we'll show you a lesson, but it's if they actually want to stop terrorism, then they should maybe think about, I don't know what to do. What would you do in such a situation where certain people have the idea that we are right and it's not a point of discussion, and if anyone doesn't agree, we'll kill them. That's the very difficult to discuss with such people. But bombing them is likely to reinforce their attitude rather than that attitude. It becomes very difficult how to apply these principles. Actually, that was the last program I did in America this year, and the last question that came up, someone asked me about preaching to Muslims or dealing with Muslims with the idea that it's a rival or a competitive or an opposing community. And I said, I'm well aware that there's a devotee here from Muslim background. But I said that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement is to give love of God. So the whole idea is to bring everyone to a higher platform. If we get into this consciousness of Hindus versus Muslims, that won't help the spread of love of God. Everyone is jiva, everyone has Krishna in their heart. How to connect or awaken the Krishna consciousness in everyone's heart? That should be our outlook. This is what I replied. Srila Prabhupada also often said that it's not that we can expect to convert everyone or that we should even try to, but that if someone is a Christian, we can convince them to be a better Christian, just like Srila Prabhupada in Australia when he met the Bishop of Melbourne. The Bishop was very open and favorable, and Prabhupada suggested that we could worship together, we can keep the deity of Jesus and Krishna, we can chant the holy names of Jesus also. But he said, but you have to stop the meat eating. Interestingly, in this purport, Srila Prabhupada talks about meat from slaughterhouses, because Srila Prabhupada pragmatically suggested that in Vedic society, well, it's standard in Vedic society that meat eating is allowed for certain people under certain circumstances. But slaughterhouses are not allowed. Animal killing is allowed under certain circumstances, not meant for highly advanced spiritual people, but for those who will do it, it can be allowed under restriction. And Srila Prabhupada explained that in the Jewish religion and in Islam, there is some restriction as to how the animal is killed. The idea is, and in Hindu religion for that matter, the idea is to regulate it so that it becomes not a very common thing. And even traditionally in all cultures, meat eating wasn't very common. In the desert, the Arabs, they would not regularly kill animals. They would sacrifice a camel sometimes. So camels are a very valuable creature for them. This regularly daily eating meat became possible with modern civilization, with factory farming and increased crop production by technological methods. Of course, the long-term result of this is disastrous, as is now being seen. And so they're able to, and transportation and refrigeration makes this all possible. Otherwise, meat eating, even for meat eaters, they wouldn't eat meat every day unless they were rich people. They'd usually die early also from eating so much meat. So Srila Prabhupada said that's allowed under certain circumstances. In Vedic culture, it's allowed for Kshatriyas and even Brahmanas. We find in the Bhagavatam even that sometimes Brahmanas would eat meat, that which is offered in sacrifice, not on a daily basis. And for Shudras, they could eat meat Kshatriyas and Brahmanas, yeah, they could eat in sacrifice, not daily. And then in Shudras, once a month they can kill an animal or have it killed by offering to the deity of Kali, but not cows. And for Chandalas, you know, you can't kill the cows. Even that was allowed in some particular. Gavalambhya. Then for the Chandalas, those who are outside the Vedic culture, they could eat cow's meat even, but no one's allowed to kill the cow. But when the animal dies, then you can take the meat and eat it. So it is allowed. Chickens, sheep, buffaloes. It's not recommended, but it is allowed. But not slaughterhouses, which are very sinful. So this question, I thought about that afterward, what I said, because the devotee asked me about our approach to, in New Jersey, in America, asked me about our approach to Muslims. And that was my reply, that we should share or try to share Krishna consciousness with them, and many will appreciate. And we can also appreciate those who are strictly following. I personally came to appreciate living in Bangladesh, those who are very faithfully following and praying. We understand from the Bhagavatam that the knowledge of God in Bhagavatam, Bhagavatattva Vijnanam, the knowledge and the practice, it's at a higher level. Everyone will say it's at a higher, their own is at the highest level. But by practical analysis, we can see that Krishna consciousness is at the highest level, but we can appreciate what God consciousness is there of others also. But yeah, I thought about this afterward, and there is also the very real question of terrorism promulgated in the name of religion. And some of our devotees in our movement, they seem to have this idea that we have to teach those Muslims a lesson and all this kind of thing. Well, it may be necessary to have a Kshatriya force also, because if we only preach peace and love, and then people take advantage of that and maybe blow up our temples or kill our devotees, then we should be prepared to someone, maybe not be our own devotees, but someone should be prepared to take action in such a regard, as Parikshit Maharaj was ready to punish the wrongdoers. However, in Kali Yuga, the situation is so disturbed that we can't quell wrongdoing only by force. That won't be possible. We have to bring people to a higher consciousness where they don't want to be violent. So that will require education, spiritual education. Otherwise, if in the name of religion people want to inflict suffering on others, it's most irreligious, actually. On the mass scale, that requires education. And no one who's actually advanced in spiritual or advanced in religious understanding will advocate some genocide or something like this in the name of religion. Anyway, the world is extremely disturbed, and Krishna consciousness is very much needed. Real knowledge of God is very much needed in human society. This meat-eating, gambling, illicit sex, intoxication, very widely spread, and people take it to be something normal, but it's disturbing. It's disturbing the whole society and polluting the consciousness of everyone. Actually, people can only indulge in these things if their consciousness is polluted, and by indulging in these things, they become more polluted. So it's a great service that devotees here going out and book distribution and preaching to distribute these books and give this knowledge. And gradually, one by one, people are taking to it, trying to understand it, but it's really, it needs to be spread very widely. But people are infatuated with the thought of enjoying themselves. Why do people engage in this meat eating with slaughterhouses? How can they be so cruel? Maybe they don't see the cruelty. In the Western countries, people, they buy meat wrapped in plastic from a supermarket. Here, chickens, mostly people take home and kill themselves. They're so heartless, they don't consider that there's so much pain the chicken has to suffer. In a butcher's shop, you'll see the goats are killed. Sunday is a bad day for goats and chickens in South India especially. People go to the church, and then on the way back, they stop at the butcher's shops. Once in Bangladesh, I remember I was at Chittagong port waiting to take a boat to Sandeep, which is an island off the coast, which is also part of Bangladesh. And in an incoming boat, there were these big baskets completely full of chickens. And from the boat, which was high above the quay, they would throw these baskets down. So all the chickens, especially ones at the bottom, they must have had their bones broken, and you could hear them screaming in pain, and they just do it routinely, one after another. Throwing them, and they're so heartless. How can they be so cruel? They're accustomed to it. One devotee informed me how he became a vegetarian before he joined the movement. He's from the West, from Germany. In the schools in the West, they do, they take children for outings to various places to see different things, to get some experience of the world and all different things that they don't normally see. So I never heard of this kind of outing, but where the teachers took the children to an abattoir, which is another way of saying slaughterhouse. So many of the children, they were vomiting when they went there, and many of them became vegetarians just by seeing that. So much suffering and how nasty it is. How can people indulge in that? What is the reason? It's intense karma, material desire, is the root of all sin. As Krishna tells Arjuna, Arjuna asks, why do we sin? Even if we don't want to. Ata kena prayukta yam papam charati purushaha anicchanapi varshnaya balamivad ivaniyojit. Why do we sin, Arjuna asked, even though we don't want to? Even if we don't want to, we feel as if we're forced. And Krishna replied, karma ish. Well, there's the rest of the verse, but the first word gives the... If there's only one word reply, that would sum it all up. It's material desire. And when that intensifies, then we don't care about the consequences. We don't care that we're harming others and harming ourselves also. Because harming others means to harm ourselves, because we get reactions for what we do. But even in the pursuit of pleasure, we may harm ourselves. In terms of the body, just like, for instance, by indulging in smoking. There's some pleasure there, I presume. But it's harmful also to the body. It gives us pain. By indulging in illicit sex, there's some immediate pleasure, but then there's the suffering of, if one indulges here and there in illicit sex, there's the high possibility that one will contract a sexually transmitted disease, most of which seem to be very painful, except AIDS, which is, well, it's a syndrome, but that it's not exactly a disease in itself, but it gives rise to all kinds of other diseases. And one will suffer in so many ways, mentally also, or one may be attacked by the husband of the woman who you had an illicit sexual relationship with, or the boyfriend. One may be one suffers from the women when they find out that the boyfriend has so many girlfriends, they become upset. So in so many, and the sinful reaction that comes in course of time, it causes so much suffering. What to speak of, even if one is even apart from illicit sex, even licit sex within marriage, for the sake of propagating children and having children, raising them, it's troublesome. Why do people do so? Because of desire. And when desire becomes more intense, then they don't care whether they're indulging in fulfillment of desires in a sinful way or a pious way, and they become more and more and more and more sinful. This education is required. That it's not enough to call oneself a Hindu, a Muslim, or Christian. But one should have transcendental knowledge, a knowledge of what's happening in this world, so that one can actually act for the sake of purification. Purification means what? Well, it means to become Krishna conscious. But purification, we can say, in the fullest sense, means to become selfless. purification in the Hindu religion, in the among the Smartas. Of course, I'm using this word Hindu. Of course, it's a conventional word. It's not a Siddhantic word. Among the followers of the Vedic literature, there are various methods of purification. For instance, taking bath is purifying. Performing achaman is purifying. Fasting is considered purifying, just like the gopis, they were fasting for the Katyayani Vrata. So these are various methods of purification. By touching a cow, one becomes purified. But real purification means purification of heart, which means to become free from material desire. And on the positive side, to become absorbed in love of Krishna, that is the highest stage, that in itself will purify one from all material desires. But Krishna consciousness also, it's not exactly according to a formula, that one really has to become selfless. So advancement in Krishna consciousness can be seen by how much one is selfless, which seems very difficult, because we're all, by practice, absorbed in ourselves. But we should understand that our real self-interest lies in becoming selfless. Selfless, the Mayavadis and Nirvisheshavadis, they would say selfless means to become totally free of any ego, but that's not possible. We do have ego. We do have a sense of I-ness. The Mayavadi's idea of selflessness is to cease to exist. An impossible proposition. But the Vaishnava's understanding is that one's material desires cease to exist and that one only wishes to serve Krishna and please Krishna. So this selflessness is required. A person who is selfless will never harm others, what to speak of indulging extremely sinful activities. So the process of Krishna consciousness is to bring us to this stage. Apart from doing all the things that we're supposed to do in Krishna consciousness, we should be very much conscious also of the need to become selfless. Selfless means that we act only for the pleasure of Krishna. We're not acting for our own pleasure. It may be that even we're doing everything we're supposed to do in Krishna consciousness, rising early, chanting the holy names, preaching, but even maybe unknown to ourselves, we're cultivating selfish desires. That's also possible. We may even justify those personal desires in the name of Krishna consciousness. For instance, when one becomes a leader in Krishna consciousness, either appointed or just as it happens, just one becomes a leader unofficially, then others come under the control to a greater or lesser extent of others. One may enjoy that control and enjoy the prestige, enjoy the sense of seeing others obey one's order. Then one partakes in the consciousness of thinking, I am controlling others. Ishvaroham, I am the controller. Then that is not selflessness. It's required that some people be leaders, but it is required that leaders be selfless also, in the fullest sense of the term. That not wanting anything for themselves, not even recognition. Although some recognition is required to be a leader, so it's a bit of a conundrum. But this consciousness, let us do it all for Krishna. Otherwise, we can do We may do so many things for Krishna, but if we want to keep a little for, even a little for ourselves, the whole thing becomes, to that extent, polluted by our own personal desires. We may build a big, beautiful temple for Krishna, but if we want people, if we are concerned that people should know, yes, this devotee has done this, this is very good, then it's not fully an offering to Krishna. Others may come and offer themselves to Krishna. But actually the atmosphere is very much created by the leaders. And others, if the leader himself is of the consciousness that, yes, we're doing it for Krishna, we're saying for Krishna, for Krishna, for Krishna, but I want to know, I want that everyone should know I'm doing it for Krishna. Then the followers also, they come to that. Recently I was in one place and devotees were coming to me one after another and saying, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm doing this preaching, I'm doing that preaching. And I would just say, I see, it's like they want, what do they want? I want to be praised, so I praise them. I tell them, oh, you're doing such wonderful service, you're such a great devotee, and they were very happy. They couldn't trace my sarcasm. That's what they wanted. So they did all that preaching, but it was all for the sake of, it seems largely for the sake of, that they should be recognized for doing so. That's why it's very good to have devotees go out on book distribution. And even on book distribution, you can be concerned that I have to show myself to be the biggest book distributor and the best book distributor. But when you're out on the streets and going door to door, people, here in India, of course, some people are pious and they may be appreciative of that, but there are many people who are also not pious and not appreciative and maybe actually inimical. So it's a good education. I often think that education in how we may not be such a great preacher as we think we are. I often think the devotees who are in India and they're preaching and people are coming, because naturally in India people have some faith in Krishna. I think it'd be very good for them to go and distribute books in the Western countries, how, or in Malawi maybe, for instance, where people don't know anything about it, don't have any inclination toward it, and you can understand that preaching's not such an easy thing. We find that here in India, where our movement is still going fairly well, that there's jostling for who will be in position, who will be the leader, this, that. In the Western countries, no one wants to be a temple president. When there was a lot of name and fame and glory and money, then there was great competition, who will be the temple president. Now all the temples are empty and it's a headache to run them on. It's very difficult to find anyone to be a temple president, which does suggest that the principle of selfishness and selflessness applies there also. We may be not such great pure devotees as we think we are. So anyway, this point, the Rajarshi, the king, he has so much power and wealth and prestige, but he has to be selfless. He has to be a wise man. Wise doesn't just mean that you've read an encyclopedia and memorized it. But one should be wise enough to be detached and understand that I've been given this service on behalf of Krishna, so I must discharge it on behalf of Krishna and not become attached and not think that I am the doer. This should be the attitude. Otherwise, if the leaders themselves have motives other than to serve Krishna, then troubles begin. And if the leader himself is practicing Krishna consciousness but has some other agenda, some personal agenda also, then the followers will also pick that up, and the whole even the preaching may spread very widely. And actually it may be spread more widely if we introduce some element of selfishness, because people can relate to that easier. If we tell people to be selfless, if we try to inculcate that, then we may not expect so many great numbers of people to come, but if we offer them Balam rice, this was the example Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur gave, that one man, one zamindar, landowner, nowadays that class has been destroyed by the socialist policies of the Indian government since independence, semi-socialistic anyway, class of landowner. So the landowner, he couldn't get any servants to stay with him. Servants would come and they would go. So it was a headache for him, because every time he had to train the servants what to do, and then they'd go away. Then a friend of his, he recommended you feed them balam rice, which I only heard of it in this Upakhyana Upadesh, in the stories told by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. I never came across it when I was in Bengal. Of course, I'm not a great rice eater. So this is a very high quality rice. He said, you feed your servants this rice with ghee every day. So he started that, and even some of the servants went away, but after a short time they would come back and say, actually I left, but you're such a great master and I only like to work for you, but actually in other places they wouldn't get such nice food. They'd become accustomed to that. So they came back for the nice food. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that even in running a spiritual institution, we may offer some incentives to appeal to people's lower nature. And he gave the example, we may give devotees titles. He would give titles to devotees, and that makes them feel, yes, now I'm recognized. In our movement also, Brahminical initiation has become like that. It's, you get initiated, that shows, okay, now I'm initiated. And then you have to become Brahmin initiated. And then, then you're really a great devotee. So that's required to keep people happy, it seems. Although that's completely militates against the whole purpose of giving Brahmin initiation. Really, this point of selflessness has to be preached. Otherwise, if we simply preach, increase the book distribution, increase the temples, increase the number of devotees, increase, 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 and we give prizes to those who make the most devotees, as we say, make devotees. We can't actually make devotees. We have no ability to make devotees, but we have that phrase. And those who distribute the most books, and you give prizes to them, and then they go and make more devotees because they want more prizes and more recognition, and they make devotees by whatever means possible, and they never instill in them any sense of selflessness, the idea that, well, you just chant Hare Krishna and somehow or other, all these other rules don't matter because we have to make many devotees, and if we have too many rules, then so many people won't join. And in this way, they're increasing and increasing and increasing the number of neophyte devotees, and because they have no sense of selflessness, they fight among themselves, because they think that my idea must be the best idea, and all these other people follow me, what's wrong with these idiot godbrothers who don't want to listen to what I say? And in this way we increase the number of neophytes who quarrel among each other, which is the nature of Kali Yuga. So really it's required a class of real brahmanas who are detached and selfless, and they should be recognized as such and followed and respected as such. But Without this kind of preaching, then to become selfless, then even though we go through the formulae of Krishna consciousness, if we don't have the idea that we're supposed to fully give ourselves to Krishna, then we won't fully give ourselves to Krishna. We may even physically do so. We may work very hard, giving up eating and sleeping. We may be inspired to spread the movement. But if we're retaining thoughts of how I will be recognized, others will praise me, or how I, another less, maybe less damaging, but facet of selfishness is the devotee who's not eager for a big position or to be recognized, but they just want to find their own little comfortable slot in the movement where they can fit in and they get their food and their clothing and no one bothers them too much. So they have a peaceful life, all their material needs taken care of, and they do whatever they have to do minimally to maintain that position. And the longer they're in that position, I don't mean here an institutional position, they may have a service as a pujari or whatever, and the longer they're there, the more difficult it is to dislodge them. For instance, I was at a center recently where going to Mangalarti was not very popular among the devotees. They had a roster of pujaris, and each day one poor suffering pujari would have to get up early in the morning to offer the Mangalarti, and no one else would be there. And it was a different pujari every day, and all the rest slept. So when one leader, devotee was appointed Tamil president, he said, okay, now you've got to get up for Mangalarti. Became a revolutionary situation. And when he wanted to get them up, then the GBC was called in and said, oh, you can't say anything to them. They're all senior devotees. They've all been here many years. So they're all well situated in their situations of comfort and no one can move them. So that's another kind of selfishness. Let us find our little comfortable slot and live there very happily. So selflessness. Selflessness, that doesn't mean self-neglect. In working hard to spread the Krishna consciousness movement, in giving one's whole energy to Krishna, one should also maintain the body, maintain one's spiritual life, not that one is working, and not having enough time for hearing and chanting and absorbing Krishna consciousness so we can give to others. So physically, mentally, spiritually, a devotee has to be fit to serve Krishna. There's this interesting statement Srila Prabhupada makes at the end of the purport. Toward the end of the purport. If we want blazing fire, we must use dry fuel. Blazing fire and moist fuel go ill together. And we may wonder, what's that got to do with anything in the purport? And we then afterwards, Srila Prabhupada writes, peace and morality can prosper only by the principles of Maharaj Parikshit and his followers. So the point is that peace, Srila Prabhupada has been talking about peace in society, that can only come about if there is morality. Just like blazing fire cannot come from moist fuel. So morality means morality means absence of slaughterhouses, intoxication, illicit sexual relations, and gambling. So a ruler like Parikshit Maharaj should be strong to root these out of the state. At the same time, in the modern age, as I was saying, it can't be by force only. There has to be education also. and purification of consciousness. We often hear discussed about stopping cow killing in India, which definitely want to stop cow killing, but as I often say to devotees here in India who advocate that our movement should get behind stopping cow slaughter, that will be possible if we can convince the Christians and the Muslims. Because we can't stop it. Even in states, most of the states of India, it's forbidden. But it goes on. So if we're actually going to stop it, then we have to convince them. It's easy enough to say, okay, let's call out the police and the army and shoot anyone who does it. But we can't shoot anyone, everyone, and those who do it and think it's part of their religion, they should be convinced why it's not actually good for them or for others. So that's it's a great challenge to try to stop cow killing, but considering that there are maybe more than 15 crore people in this country who think it's part of their religion, then we have to convince them. We have to start on that. We have to start work on that. So that's quite a big and complex topic. Society in the modern age is very complex. Mass purification can begin by chanting the holy names of Krishna. That should also be, that should be promoted. And promoting the Krishna consciousness, that should also be. The philosophy, the understanding. So we have a lot of work to do. A lot of work to do. Yeah, any questions, please? I just touched on some points here in the lecture, which, as I said, they can be quite complex and they may require more detailed discussion on the practical level. I'm thinking about these things. What to do exactly? It should be thought about more. It's not that exactly. It's not that. You can just go like that and give a solution to everything. Just like I saw it in the news yesterday, Hindu-Muslim violence in Gujarat. I wonder what the government, they should appoint some think tank to on the whole Hindu-Muslim relations in India, instead of dealing with it in a piecemeal basis. What should be done? The leaders of the different communities should be spoken to. Something should be at the ultimate level. We have to stop selfishness. But in Vedic culture, it's not so idealistic to think that we can stop selfishness. You just can't stop it. That's why there's Varnashram. There's Brahmacharya, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyasa. Sannyasa is supposed to be completely selfless. Grihastha life is meant for, there's some allowance for selfishness. The Shudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Brahmana. Brahmana is supposed to be selfless. Kshatriya to a lesser extent, Vaishya to a lesser extent, Shudra to a lesser extent. It's understood people are at different levels. We can't... there have to be different dealings with different people at different levels. So, why isn't the government thinking of how to? It's an ongoing problem, and it's not. Just can't solve it by.
It's political agenda for them.
It's a political agenda for them to promote differences between Hindus and Muslims. Yeah, they actually cared for the country, they wouldn't. Yes, Srila Prabhupada also said that there's so much problems mostly caused by the politicians. Yeah.
Maharaj, my question is in connection you were saying about preaching. So I just remember that Prabhupada, he wrote, I think, a letter to Sudama Prabhu in 1972. He said that stop, you know, making milk. You have to boil it down. You have to make it thick and sweet. So
Boiling the milk. You understand what this analogy is. I also understand it, but I'll just explain that. Srila Prabhupada, in one letter, wrote that we should not make. Now he said we should not concentrate so much on making devotees, but on training those devotees who have already joined. And he gave the example of boiling down the milk to make it thicker and more wholesome. But at the same time, although Srila Prabhupada said that, he went on promoting the spread of the Krishna conscious movement.
Yes.
So he would sometimes say or do both things. Just like to Tejas Prabhu, he wrote him a letter, and when Tejas Prabhu was in Delhi and Prabhupada gave him more and more services, he had to establish a temple, make all the MLA's life members. He made more than 100 MLA's life members at that time. He was overseeing. He had to finance the maintenance of the Vrindavan temple. So many things. At one time, Tejas Prabhu, he had no place to stay. At one time, he was staying in a barber's shop when it closed down at night, and then he'd be out all day and come back at night. So at one time, Tejas Prabhu wrote a letter, and Prabhupada is saying, I'm just overwhelmed. And Prabhupada said, the main thing is not that you do so many services. The main thing is the spirit that you do it in. There's no need to over-endeavor. And then 2 days later, Prabhupada sent another letter giving more services for Tejas to do. So both things are there. But I do feel that in our movement, on the whole, is emphasizing a lot on bringing more and more people without sufficient emphasis on training those who come. We become very concerned with getting more and more numbers, becoming popular, but not actually training those who come. And sometimes it seems by promoting selfishness, we're trying to attract people, trying to indulge people in what they want, instead of training them that we have to live and act as Krishna wants. Then we become a mundane religion. Yeah, any other point? Yeah. Yeah, Srila Prabhupada said we want to create a class of brahmanas, yeah? Oh, in the spirit of Kshatriyas. Oh, what I understand from this is that Srila Prabhupada wanted brahmanas who would preach very strongly and be very brave. Brahmanas in the preaching, just like Madhvacharya. He was combative in his preaching, like Prabhupada himself. A very outgoing, very determined to spread Krishna consciousness, determined to overcome all obstacles. Brahmin for himself may be very detached, but then for preaching Krishna consciousness may be very attached. It's just like Srila Prabhupada appeared to be very attached to the land in Juhu, in Bombay. And he made a big fight. Even other people, Mr. Nair had cheated by selling that land to them again and again. And others had just withdrawn and thought there's no use to fight this, we're just wasting our money going on fighting this. But Prabhupada didn't withdraw. Mr. Nair, he would sell that land again and again and again, and then continue to occupy it and make all different legal proceedings. And this way he cheated one person after another with the cooperation of the Bombay Municipal Corporation. But then with Prabhupada, he didn't. He thought Prabhupada would also withdraw, but he didn't. And Prabhupada fought and fought and fought. And it was a difficult fight. And Mr. Nair didn't give up either. When finally Prabhupada had everything sealed, signed, everything in the name of ISKCON, Prabhupada's comment was, that was a good fight. Mr. Nair died in the process. While the fight was going on, and his wife continued the fight. So, Hare Krishna, we'll finish there. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.